You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey everyone, welcome to Thesis on Joan. I'm Holly, they, them.
And I'm Megan, she, her.
Thesis on Joan is a podcast dedicated to amplifying voices from the LGBTQ+ community in the New York performing arts scene and examining the industry from a queer perspective. Join fan queers and theater professionals, Megan and I, as we sit down with groundbreaking theater folk from Brooklyn Cabaret performers to people backstage and on Broadway. For many queers, theater has been an escape. This podcast looks to have open conversations on where we've come from and where we're headed as a community while queering the canon along the way. Hey, Megan.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, you know, hanging in during the pandemic, every day is an adventure in my apartment.
I mean, how are you? Right now, our listeners can't see, but the adventure is you have to hold a blanket over your head to get optimal sound quality. And it looks like you're playing parachute from like kindergarten. I love it.
I usually go in our bedroom to record because there's more fabric around, so it absorbs, or it, I don't know, it makes better sound quality, but it's Saturday and I'm just feeling like I don't want to move all my stuff in there. So, and I think my partner's taking a nap. So, you know,
good partner,
a good partner. Yeah. Well, first of all, we're over halfway through the season now.
Woo!
Which feels so wild.
It's so crazy.
Yeah. I can't believe that. You know, you proposed this to me last October.
Oh my gosh, we're gaining on a year of this being like a baby out in the world that we're working on. That's so exciting.
Wow. It is cool. What's been your favorite thing about the podcast so far?
Oh man. I know I said at the beginning that I was like really excited to meet my heroes. So I think the best part has been like meeting all these amazing artists and also just realizing that they're all, of course, amazing humans too. And, it just feels like such a little quarantine gift to get to like, you know, FaceTime Diana and like talk to Becca and yeah, just see Ty as he's moving outside. It's just been really cool. How about you? Yeah. What's been your favorite so far?
I think from working on artistic projects in the past, I've always been kind of like supporting other people's visions and what they wanted to accomplish. And this is the first time I've really felt like, oh, this is like our project. And like, we're really designing like who we're talking to and what the structure of the podcast is and getting to make like more artistic decisions that I, you know, aren't based in other folks to support their vision. It's really like our vision has been really cool.
I love that. There's no other person I'd rather share a vision with.
Oh, same.
And also so great that I know, like, I'm never going to propose a question. You're going to be like, that's a little too much. So, whether it's about fanfic or about something that, like, normally they'd be like, let's not get into those heavy issues. I'm glad that we're able to do that.
Oh, no, let's do dive way into heavier issues.
All the heavy issues. Yeah. So how have you been staying sane during all this? What's been keeping you going?
Oh, so right when the pandemic started, I got a Switch. I found a Switch online and they were like in heavy demand. And
oh, they were.
When I first started looking, they were all sold out and I was like kicking myself for not buying because I've been thinking about getting one for like a year and I was just so mad at myself that I hadn't done it yet. And then I just kept looking on the Nintendo website every day And finally, one showed up as available at, from like Best Buy, and I like jumped on it and got it. So I started playing Zelda Breath of the Wild. And oh my God, that game has gotten me through so much during these past few months. Like, it's not inherently queer, but listen, first of all, I was very surprised that you don't actually play Zelda. I thought I was going to be Zelda. And then I'm like, who is this person? Yep.
Who's this legless looking dude?
Right. And then I'm like, oh, so I'm playing this like kind of femme tomboyish. Yep. I just think of them as like a boyish lesbian or like a trans guy with, you know, like he has such beautiful eyes and hair.
I love Link. I definitely have a video game crush on Link.
Yeah, I mean, he is, you know, a younger Legolas. It makes sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, just like the detail in Zelda and all the puzzles. I just love the puzzles so much. And, you know, I don't really like killing the monsters. If they could just run around in the grass without a shirt on and solve puzzles
and
in
like
the shrine.
The little diamonds. Yeah.
Yeah, and the Korok seeds. I'm like still working on the Korok seeds. I'm like 500 out of 900, but you know,
it's good to have there. A goal. Yeah.
Yeah. But like, I've just lost so many hours. Like, instead of, you know, sitting on my couch and wallowing in despair, I just like it totally takes my mind out of the world and like focused on like whatever challenge Link is facing at the time.
I don't think it's lost though, because you're like working your mind on the puzzles and like it's clearly bringing you joy. So that's, I think that's time well spent. That's great.
Yeah, I hope so. But my partner has not loved it at times when I am not paying attention to her and just like, leave me alone. Let me be Link.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, good escapism. I don't think I realized. So this is your first Zelda game you've ever played?
Oh yeah. Yeah, first time.
Oh, okay. Oh my gosh. Again, as we go back to like, we should have been friends as children, I would have been making you play Ocarina of Time all the time with me. That's like, if you ever need to, there's probably like a internet way to play it on the computer, because I'm sure it's not super high def and fancy, but those N64 versions of Zelda were like always my favorite as a kid. They're so great.
But what's been giving you joy during the pandemic?
Yeah. What's been bringing me joy, she got a shout out, I think, in the Sally Kate episode, is my puppy Indigo, who is not named after Indigo Girls, even though it's something that I'm continuously asked by every queer encounter on the street. I should have thought of that before. My parents have a dog named Blue, who has one blue eye. Indy has one blue eye. So we're like, we're going to continue this color tradition. And that's where her name's Indigo. But we've had her for almost 3 months now, which is insane. I've been wanting a dog for a long time. And Holly, this is something we talked about a lot, because we were both like vying for those shelter dogs early on. And it was just like, everyone was adopting dogs, which was so great. So we were really lucky to find Indy. And it's been, here's my word of advice. If you are in a relationship with someone and you have ever talked about the possibility of bringing a human life into your, a small human life into your family, definitely try to get a dog first, because, well, boy, is it a lot of work, especially a puppy. Like, she is peeing on everything, you know, and she's just like, thank God they're cute. Like, that's how they're still, like, surviving today and being human companions. But, like, twice this past week, she has tricked me by peeing in another room, hearing my reaction. And as I run, she goes and swipes the food off my plate that I was eating.
Oh, when no, she did it again.
Yeah, she did it again. It was bad. And this time she got some hot sauce. So I'm hoping that that's like, okay, never again. But she's doubtful. Like a little bundle of baby Australian Shepherd joy. And yeah, it's just been like, also, okay, this is the thing about Indy that has like, what I didn't expect, but really has helped me during the quarantine, is I have to walk her like 3-4 times a day. And I have made so many new neighborhood friends, right? I've lived in this neighborhood for going on 9 years now. And I probably knew like 8-10 other people that go to the musical theater night at the bar, obviously. But yeah, the just meeting so many like dog parents has been really cool because it's just people that I probably would never normally interact with, like someone who's an event planner that does mostly bar mitzvahs and someone who's like a tech person working from home, some teachers in the neighborhood, you know, just people that I wouldn't normally encounter in my day to day. And it's just like having a kid. I'm sure you set up play dates for your puppy and like, gotta wear this dog out somehow. So we gotta go outside and see Daisy. Like that's how it works. And also I've been like pawning her off on you guys in our little queer circle to try to bring joy to everybody. So,
I mean, we've had a couple, you know, outdoor eating, excursions since this started, and I've seen Indy twice now, I think. And, she's just the softest, cutest friggin' thing ever. And she's so smart. I worry about you because she's going to take over your family.
He already like slowly is. My partner and I had a chance to go camping, a couple weeks ago. Holly's favorite thing, camping. Well, we're going to get you there one day.
Lies.
And after three nights in the tent, Indy wakes up and is crying to go outside. And I just wasn't fast enough with my shoes. And she just unzipped the tent herself with her little mouth. And so definitely keeping me on my toes. That's for sure. But it's been great.
I feel like we both got things that we were trying, that were in scarce supply and trying to get at the beginning of quarantine. And we both got the thing that we needed at the time.
It's true. It's definitely what I needed to keep me going. Cause we got Indy right at, when did you get your Switch?
It was only like a couple, like maybe a month into quarantine. Yeah.
And we found out we were definitely getting her beginning of May, which I think was right when like I got furloughed, right when I was really like Broadway's not coming back for a long time. So a little crazy light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah. And where my partner and I are about to travel to the Midwest for a month, to Ohio and Michigan to see our families. And we're going to try and find a dog out there. So stay tuned. Maybe might have some dog news in the next few weeks.
Oh, I hope it happens. Oh, yeah. So excited. We need to expand our queer dog chosen family.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Also, I want listeners to send us their dog pics if they have dogs.
Oh my God. Yep. All the dogs.
I mean, you can send your other pet pics too. That's fine. We're just especially dog fans on this podcast. So.
Well, I am so excited to get into this interview with Diana O. They've been such a hero for me for the last few years after seeing my lingerie play and just completely losing my shit during that show. Like, it was just such a visceral experience that I haven't really experienced in theater before. And it was this a dream that we get to talk to them.
And having this conversation with them, I know is like for both of us, just such like a, oh, look at the hope that we have to move forward with theater. So
yeah.
Thanks to Diana for that too.
I'm so glad. Yeah. So excited to share this with everyone. And yeah. Yay, Diana.
Yay, Diana.
Today we're sitting down with Diana O. Diana O is a multi-genre performer, singer, songwriter, musician, actor, and creator of performance, installation, concert, ritual, and party. O is a Refinery 29 top LGBTQ influencer and the first queer Korean American interviewed on Korean broadcast radio. The creator of the Infinite Love Party, My Lingerie Play, Clairvoyance, a year-long installation and concert series in Harvard Yard, the Boston Public Library, Institute of Contemporary Art, Harvard Arboretum, and ART, 24-Hour Punk, Asian People Are Not Magicians on Mike.com, and My Hate Letter to the Great American Theater at the Public Theater. She was the mentor of Sean Randall's The Making of How to Save the World in 90 Minutes for the Cherry Lane's Mentor Project in 2019, and TV and film Queering, How to Be Single, New York is Dead at the Tribeca Film Festival, Hey Yoon featuring Janet Mock, and Unicorn Land on NPR and Vice. O tours with their art in unexpected spaces and enjoys not fitting into boxes. Hey, Diana, welcome to the podcast.
Welcome.
Hello. Hi.
So, Diana, we usually start by asking guests to share their name, their pronouns, and anything else that you would like to share about how you identify.
Sure. I'm Diana O. I use they and she pronouns, and I identify as a human with a very soft heart.
I love that. So you describe the work you do as art with a capital A. And can you explain a bit how you classify art with a capital A?
Sure. I think it's for protective measures. So that, it's kind of how I keep myself honest and keep my art honest from, a vulnerable emotional place. It's so amazing because I just ended this 2-hour conversation. Basically that was just talking about, how to bring my work to the next level into the commercial realm. And commercial has always been one of those words that I cringe at, because I for so long have associated commercial with complacency and complicitness and violence and damage and heteronormativity and cis normativity and white normativity, that now to speak about going commercial with as an intention, I've had to reframe it as just larger, right? Commercial doesn't have to mean all those things. My definition of it is just for it to have a wider impact, a larger outreach. And what I don't want it to do is have that come at the expense of my morals or values or principles. And so that's why it's important to me that I create art with an A, which also allows me to be in charge of my voice and not ever feel like I've become someone's, cog, plaything, lemming.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense. Definitely. Yeah.
So you describe yourself as an unboxable artist. You've created as a songwriter, a director, an actor, a performance artist, many other different mediums. Can you talk a little bit more about your process of building a form, if any, for a particular message and how that changes with each project you pursue?
Yeah. Thank you for that question. I've taken to labeling myself as unboxable because for so long and so often, people didn't know how to box me in. They didn't quite know how to sell me in quotation marks. And just so that I didn't, pursue a life of an artist with frustration, I was just like, okay, let me just take care of it. And let me just let y'all know that it's okay if I'm unboxable. It's okay that I contain multitudes just like you, and I do identify as a polymath, as in somebody who, is capable of doing many things and loving doing many things and is able to, pull off doing many things, with joy and capability. So I took to the word unboxable, because people were, having trouble explaining it and kind of, doing the elevator pitch for me. And I also think that as, because of my sexuality and my sexual tendencies, that goes pretty unboxable as well. And it was kind of my way of making sure, that the man never really got me down, that just because I didn't fit into people's boxes didn't mean that I was any less than, or that my art had any less value, or that my art was less valid. And then in terms of creating it, so much of it has to do with what the invitation is. When I speak of opportunities and I speak of, anytime I get to do my work, whether as a creator, an actor, a singer, a songwriter, a musician, a maker, a person leading the room, whatever it is, I like to think of those as invitations, because what you are essentially inviting me to do is you are inviting me to be my full self and the whole version of myself. And if you aren't inviting me to be my whole self, then that isn't necessarily an invitation, in which case then that is a job. So for me, it's kind of having to separate between, well, what are those spaces that are invitations where I'm being invited in, and then what are those spaces where I'm being hired to do a job? And in terms of, you know, the forms I create, which I really, really believe in recreating form and creating form, and it just has so much to do with our identities. And, you know, my parents have had to definitely recreate themselves as Korean immigrants moving to America. And I definitely feel like I've had to create and recreate myself as a Korean American, queer identified thing with person, you know. And that I just feel like so many of my friends, I've just watched them create and recreate themselves. And I think it's such a healthy, wonderful thing to do. And it's also, I'm always questioning, like, well, why are we so addicted to that specific form and for how long? And once I realized that, well, it's been ever since, you know, the making of America, you know, I've always just kind of had to question, like, well, who made America? And maybe that needs to change too, you know? So you know, it's always what I create is always determined by the deadline, like the literal, like, oh shit, I literally have this thing that's due and I need to follow through with it. And I believe in deadlines being an incredible doula in terms of birthing art. and the space, you know, the space is such an informant for me for what I want to create. And then where my heart is at, you know, I really believe in a heart forward process. And if I can't feel good doing it, then I'm not going to do it. And that kind of goes for everything I do, even if that means I'm hired as an actor. And I think that comes from, you know, cause I had spent, you know, maybe 1 or 2 years kind of doing it in a way that I was like, this doesn't feel good. And I'm just an incredibly impatient person that I can only stand that for so long.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the unboxable seems to fit pretty clearly into the, like, queer spectrum and identity, and especially as a POC queer person.
Yeah.
How has the queer community influenced the theater spaces that you create, and how does the term chosen family apply or not to the theater spaces you make too?
Yeah. I believe so hard in chosen family. You know, I've defined chosen family for me as the people who you graduate into sexuality with, you know, cause we just need people who are close to us who can hold our sexual desires and, you know, we'll be able to turn to them and they will love us unconditionally and they will be able to hold our desire, you know, with care and courage and courtesy and keep us safe, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's what chosen family has become to mean to me. And, you know, I done an installation about chosen families in Harvard Yard, for one of my clairvoyance installations. And even then I had to dive into, like, wow, what does chosen family really mean to me? And I had to really define it for myself. And, so that's a really recent realization I had. And then in terms of, you know, the queer community, like informing the spaces I make, I mean, I just feel like there's just no separation between my desire and my artistic impulses because it's just so intertwined. You know, my social life is so intertwined with what I make because my pleasure is so intertwined with what I make. And obviously, like, if I'm going to go socialize, why would I socialize in, like, a shitty, unfriendly space that makes me feel bad, you know? So I think with my art, you know, I'm trying to make spaces that make me feel good. And in turn, just kind of trusting that, well, if it's going to make me feel good, then it'll probably also make other people feel good too. You know, I do take my friendships really, really seriously. And so I don't think I don't think for me, it's not like, oh, I'm going to focus on this one community, and really make art, for this one community, because I think that can feel a little like, I don't know, like I'm gonna dabble in, you know, making Filipino food tonight or whatever. And I'm trying to make a metaphor here, but like, you know, but I think for me, it's actually a lot more simple, where I'm just trying to really honor, the integrity of my desire and my relationships and my friendships. And that feels A, completely manageable, and B, true to me. And if by effect, you know, if that happens to speak to, you know, a large amount of people, then that's bonus, and that's extra yummy points. Yay, yum.
And speaking of a large amount of people, we'd love to hear a little bit more from you about partying as art and how you use that in your work.
Yeah, it's so important. It's so important. You know, I had a therapist once really break it down for me, where she was like, oh, wow, it's no wonder your art is so big and sparkly and colorful and bombastic, because you were never given space when you were younger, you know. And when I was younger, growing up in LA, you know, the youngest of three kids, Korean immigrant family, you know, I wasn't given my own space, my own room, my own closet, my own bathroom, my own bed. You know, I had shared a bed with a sibling or a parent up until I was 17 years old and left for college. And so I wasn't really given a space to have those particular creative outlets. You know, my friendships were definitely a creative outlet for me, but in terms of creating, you know, stuff in a room, like having like playtime in a room, it's just, I didn't really have that kind of privacy. And so now that I'm older, and now that, you know, things like resources exist and like support systems and producers and like people who like actually want to see your vision come to life, and designers and rooms and all this stuff, you know, now I just feel like I have all this pent up playtime energy, where I'm just like, oh my God, well, if I don't put my imagination somewhere, then it's just gonna like die with me in a journal, and that's gonna suck. And you know, and I just love a dance floor, because a dance floor is like, I don't have to talk to anybody, I don't have to explain myself to anybody. I can just dance and let something else take over. I don't even have to think about it, you know. And in fact, like, the less you think, the better. And I'm always going to be pro that than, you know, thinking.
Wow. So why is it important for you to have consent, which we don't usually associate with theater, be such a focus and a community agreement in your pieces too?
Wow. Yeah. I think definitely to right the wrongs, for sure. You know, to right the wrongs that, you know, my body has experienced definitely growing up. And also because my work is so tied into my desire and my fun and pleasure and joy. You know, it's the same thing for my personal life, is that consent makes those things happen for me. And then if my trust is broken, or if my consent is broken, or if I am not given the agency to provide consent or not, then I am in a scared place. Then literal trust is broken. Then, you know, I can't quite lose myself within the parameters of the room, you know, because I want to know that at the end of the day, like, I can do the drug, I can do the drug, but then I'll always have a say in like, okay, that's enough drug for me. or I can be like, today I'm not going to do the drug. I actually just want to watch everybody else do the drug. And I want to know that I have control over that and no one's sitting there forcing drugs upon me, because that's just so fucked up, whether you're in the theater or like on a sidewalk, you know, no one wants to live that life. And because I, you know, definitely being a Korean person who, you know, I didn't get to have a lot of conversations about sex and sexuality, growing up, you know, I get to have them now, and I definitely feel like growing up queer, I definitely didn't get to have conversations about that growing up, and I just always knew that I was an extrovert, and I didn't have any shame really around it. You know, I would never wear pants if I could have it my way, you know, and I want to know that I can not wear pants and also not get killed all in the same day.
Can I ask a follow-up question? And if this is too personal, tell me to fuck off, but sure. has your family seen your work?
Fuck off. No. yeah, they totally have. They absolutely have. And, you know, my dad loves music and I've always had that connection with him. And yeah, he passed away, you know, last year. And, you know, my dad, you know, it was so much less about like the sexual liberation of my body and all of that. And he just loved seeing the music. And my mom, you know, she just thought of it as so brave, so brave. But she does have this, there's this joke where, you know, she loves my music but hates my stories. She's like, she just, but that's her way. I know that for her, she's just being protective, you know, because she's, my parents were born, into the Korean War, at the very end of the Korean War. And then in 1980, you know, Korea went through a time of martial law, which wasn't really any different from what we're going through with Donald Trump right now. And, you know, my father was an outspoken not a politician, but he was on his way to becoming a politician. You know, he was a very outspoken civil rights activist in Korea. Wow. And yeah, and he was tortured by the government and caught. And, you know, I think for my parents, and definitely for my mother, they associated speaking out with getting caught, being punished, you know, because they were somebody who had been, they were people who had been through that. And a lot of my parents' friends had been through that. And so I think for them to see their youngest child, you know, out in the street doing installations and, in their lingerie and doing very, public, loud, sweaty things. There was, of course, that fear that creeps in. You know, I know that for them, it comes from a protective place of wanting to make sure that nothing bad happens to me.
Yeah. Totally. I recently found my Korean birth family, and I've been like, trying to kind of talk to them about what's happening right now and for the Black Lives Matter movement. And they, you know, especially my parents don't speak any English. So I've been like finding resources in Korean and sending it to them, but I have like no idea how they're receiving it. And yeah, I feel like language around racism and anti-Blackness is so specific and nuanced, and like, the translation apps are not really helping me like really understand what they're responding to. And yeah, but I feel like there's that sentiment of like, oh, we just want you to be safe. Like, don't go outside. Don't go to the protests because we just want you to be safe.
And anyway. Obviously you're not going to listen. And
right. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
But yeah, but I hope to like keep having those conversations with them.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to your work. So I saw my lingerie play, and that was such a transformative experience for me to like see for the very first time a queer Korean being just so unapologetically themselves and like such a rock star. And do you feel like the lack of representation of Asian and especially queer Asian folk affect what you choose to create?
Wow. Fascinating. Well, thank you for seeing that, and thank you for reflecting that, because I definitely, you know, it's you seeing that and saying that that kind of gives me the courage to be who I am. And I literally obviously do it for you and people like you. And so I just want to thank you so much for giving me that strength and that reminder, you know. I actually, I mean, instinctively, it was, my answer was like, wow, it's so much less about like the representation I've been shown and so much more about the people behind the scenes working on the work, you know, the producers at play, the marketing people, the people selling tickets, the people doing outreach. Like, it's the lack of representation in those realms that I think create blocks for artists who identify as marginalized, you know. That kind of prevents more people from breaking through, because it is such a climb to get to a place of like, this is who I am. This is what I want to make. Here's what I'm not willing to compromise on. Please don't talk about my work in this way and that thing. Here's how to talk about my work in this way and this thing, you know, and how to like keep it in the positive and keep it on, you know, get everybody on the same page. And, you know, because definitely if my work isn't liberating me, then it's liberating nobody. And if I'm feeling trapped by my work, then it's gonna show, because I'm that, I just feel like I'm that transparent, and I'm just such a bad liar that I can't lie. I can't do it. I've been really bad at it, and people know, you know, I am an open heart, but it's like, I, like, and I rarely dislike people, but when I don't, I can't quite fake the smile enough, and I've been caught many times. So it's, you know, it's definitely like a blessing and a curse when that happens. But yeah, I would say that it's the lack of representation behind the scenes that makes it difficult when it becomes difficult.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
We'll talk about this a little bit with a later question, but yeah, totally. Having been in many of those rooms, as I know Holly has been too, it's just very homogenous. And, I know being a white woman, I'm part of that. but yeah, I think a lot of folks think that if the representation is on stage, it doesn't necessarily matter what's happening behind the scenes. So just thanks for vocalizing that. So going back to, kind of the sense of community and the joy in your work. I think, I know speaking personally, a lot of us could really use some of the joy that is found in Infinite Love Party right now. What do you think, how can we find some of that joy in a world of socially distanced lives? Or what do you think is going to be like our version of that today, or your version of that today?
This conversation, the fact that you're, I think the two of you have, it feels like such a clarity of purpose and intention and action. You know, all we really need, I think, to be happy is just what are our pockets of activation? You know, what actually moves us enough to do something? Because at the second that we're doing something and we can turn the mind off and we can turn the anxiety dial down, when we're actively in the pursuit of something. So I think whatever people are, you know, whatever anyone is able to do to take care of themselves in that way, to just, you know, remember again what they like, remind yourself of what you like, remind yourself of the things you enjoy, and remember that we don't have to necessarily sit in mourning of all these things that we enjoy. Like, the things we enjoyed before social distancing are still things we enjoy now, and we can still have it, you know, where it's like, okay, so I love going out to dance, and I miss that fiercely. I miss dancing with a group of people. Holy shit. But if I know that, then it's like, I know that music is all I need to hear to activate me and get me up on my feet and out of my fucking misery. and that's not to say it's easy, because the mind is a powerful thing, and the mind can be our best friend and our worst enemy, you know, all within minutes. And, you know, meditation is, and I this is coming from somebody who is a lazy fucking meditator. You know, when I meditate, same. I'm like, right, same. I'm like, I'm going to breathe for 3 minutes and it's going to like fix all my chakras. You know? So, but it's amazing how those 3 minutes of breathing literally are like, it's all good. Wow. I paused for I like stopped saying shitty things to myself for 3 minutes. Thank God. You know, and that's kind of all I need to just get myself active again. And there is actually something more intimate now about, you know, talking on the phone with my friends that feels really soft and really nice. And I guess I think because I felt like, well, what did we think was going to happen? Of course the world was going to break. And of course America was going to break. We were at a breaking point. Like, you wanted, like, the whoever you is, the empirical you, like, or we all wanted so much, so soon, so fast, all the time, that it's like, I guess there's a part of me that's like, I'm not surprised that there's an energy out there that was just begging for a pause, you know, and maybe because we weren't taking care of ourselves enough. And if we're not taking care of ourselves, then we're not taking care of each other. And I know that I definitely could have done a better job at taking care of myself and taking care of other people. So I've welcomed the pause for as weird and terrible and nasty as it is. There's a lot of wonderfulness coming out of it too.
Yeah, I hope it is like a reset and an opportunity for a lot of change and growth right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And kind of relating to we were thinking about clairvoyance, your installation to the White People Read.
Yeah.
And thinking about like taking care of yourself versus taking care of others, is like, how do you balance calling in allies while also holding people accountable with your work?
Ooh. I don't know. I mean, how do you? I'm still learning, right? It's like, I'm still learning. I just know that for me, I have to do it to center the people I want to center, because, you know, that is what brings me joy. Like, right? Like, making something that is like so so super cis heteronormative, like centering white folks is just the thing that's not going to necessarily bring me joy. And so I think it's less about like, you know, holding you accountable and pointing your finger at it, and more about like, let me celebrate and center who I want to celebrate and center, because those are the people who are celebrated and centered in my social life. So let me do that. Let me focus on that. And then by virtue of that, I guess it does hold people accountable. It holds the space accountable to, accountable to that mission. But I don't start from the negative, I guess is what I'm trying to say, I'll always try to find a way to root it in the positive, so that I don't get burnt out, so that I don't just become this like angry artist where it's like, that's a lie, because a lot of my art brings me a lot of pleasure, you know? And it's also, I will also say that it's very pleasurable to like rage sing and sing one of my punk songs and like release that too. You know, I just, if it makes me feel free, it makes me feel free. And that's that.
And I think we saw some of that when we got to catch your online version of My Hate Letter to the Great American Theater. And that was incredible. Thank you for doing that in quarantine. But a lot of the frustrations and demands in that are now being echoed even further throughout the theater community. I guess for the folks who didn't get a chance to see it, what would you say are the, in your opinion, the most urgent steps that you want to see American theater take towards change? And do you think it's even salvageable at this point?
Right. I do think it's salvageable. I think it's salvageable because people won't run out of money. You know, the people who have money won't run out of it. And I think essentially at the end of the day, what we are talking about is a reallocation of resources, because the people who are being centered and who are given the permission to take the spotlight also happen to be the people who are very highly paid. That's not a right. coincidence. I think some amazing steps forward, something that would feel like progress is the folks who are wanting the help, and especially the folks who are in privileged positions, whether that is financially, historically, or visibly, you're visibly privileged. Whatever you are able to do to allow folks of color and folks from marginalized identities, whatever you're able to do to allow those folks to code switch less, that is it. All we want to do is code switch less. All we want to do is to be able to express ourselves authentically without fear of repercussions, without fear of losing our job, losing money, losing relationships. We want to be able to be ourselves and have you help us be ourselves. And with that comes a lot more trust, and a lot more handing over of resources, and a lot more of loosening the reins and loosening the control on what artists are creating. You know, I think that definitely, you know, to each their own, some artists really thrive on a lot of notes and taking in, like, I just need a lot of notes. I need a lot of da 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 da. And I can confidently say that I am not one of those artists. Like, because so much of my art, it's like those notes don't even apply. You know, it's like that school of thought doesn't even apply. I don't necessarily want to write the next Tennessee Williams magnum opus, you know, four part play. And so allowing for new forms to be created and encouraging artists who haven't been given the permission to take up that space, you know, giving them a healthy amount of encouragement too, knowing that, we're at a time where we're kind of in this like awkward transition phase of, of sharing the spotlight.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And there's more there. I mean, I can go on and on and on, but that's, you know, that's one thing that I think could help, you know?
Step one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you also talk about in My Hate Letter to the Great American Theater that you, you're uncomfortable with claiming yourself as a theater artist.
Yeah.
What would make you feel more willing to claim that label?
I don't know if I ever will be comfortable claiming that label in this lifetime. You know, I like that. You know, I like being an artist. I like keeping my channels open. You know, if you had told me that 5 years ago I was going to be on this podcast interview with you talking about the things that we're talking about, I would have been like, there's no way. You know, if I had kind of defined myself before I even made the work, I just feel like I would have cut myself short. Mm-hmm. And so I think I feel that same way about this, like, you know, claiming theater as my space and my soul space. Yeah. And I mean, soul, like S-O-L-E, you know, my discomfort with that is just because I don't want to tie myself down in this like strictly monogamous relationship where, you know, I just know that I'm a very poly spirited person. and I'm going to want to work in so many mediums. Like, I don't even know yet. You know, I love creating installation, and I didn't know that I loved creating installation until I started making installations. You know, I love working in museum spaces. I love, you know, even finding music writing and songwriting. Like, I didn't set out with the intention to find it. If anything, it found me. And so I guess that's why I love calling myself an artist and just telling folks that I'm a creative, you know, I'm an artist that keeps my channels open. It just allows me to keep my imagination alive, and not feel owned by anyone or anything.
And I'm hoping that's kind of echoed through more of our traditional channels now that we've been forced to not necessarily stick to the one form or one, like people have been kind of forced to look at how they create and change. So you're definitely an inspiration for that, for sure.
Thank you.
So we were talking a little bit more about how we need to continue to create more space for folks. But are there any theaters or artists that you could point to that have made you feel seen or represented, if any?
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course, I feel like I wouldn't be here if there weren't other people to look up to. I have an obsession with Yoko Ono, and I always have had, you know, in terms of an artist who I do feel like is undervalued. I think she's the most undervalued popular artist in the American canon. You know, she's just somebody who has kept the channels open. You know, she's a performer. She started off as a visual artist. She makes music. She makes poetry. She makes street art. She puts her stuff in mediums. You know, she just kind of has made a living getting to be her. Which for me is just the ultimate goal. Is all I want to do is just be paid to be me. You know, you know, I don't even necessarily want to create a persona of me. I just want to be me. So she's somebody who I look up to a great deal. Mark and Sophie, who work at ART, Mark Lunsford and Sophie Onceval. Mark Lunsford runs the Oberon Space, and he's also, you know, a producer at ART. And those two folks were the real reason why I was able to create what I was able to create with Clairvoyance. You know, they just gave me so much access, so much trust. We were able to be on the same page. I really felt like they heard me and they understood me. And I think what it comes down to is that I'm realizing how rare those spaces are where you feel heard. So I really, I look to them as, really beautiful producers because they really, want to get to know the artist. And I think that's wonderful. Other folks I look up to my mother a whole lot, just for being able to, do the possible in completely impossible situations. I mean, I really feel that way about any immigrant parent who maintains a relationship with their child. It's just like, I just feel like I really know the work that it took to get there. There's a group of parents called the API Rainbow Parents. And it's this organization that I'm really obsessed with. And, I look to those parents a lot for inspiration. For strength, really, because it's less about the inspiration and more about strength. I guess the people who I do look up to they're people who make me feel strong, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you both, like, this is giving me strength.
Well, vice versa too.
Yeah.
Oh, good. But,
yeah. Okay. I feel like when we were planning for this podcast, you were like the first person I thought of. I'm like, oh, nothing screams like queer theater to me like Dana O. So yeah. I'm so excited.
You're number
here.
One on the list.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you mentioned the API Rainbow Parents, and we have a section every episode called Queer Gives, where we shout out different organizations or cooperatives supporting the LGBTQ community. And you had said those were one of the folks you wanted to talk about. So is there anything else you want to share about them or the other group that you mentioned?
Yeah. So the API Rainbow Parents are, you know, they're an organization who I met through the National Korean Queer and Trans Conference. Which was definitely a life-altering event for me to be surrounded by so many Korean, queer, and trans people in America, which I know that for us, it can feel like maybe we're one of 10. And so to kind of be surrounded by one of thousands across the nation was a pretty powerful, spectacular experience. And I didn't know that this group existed, but the API Rainbow Parents, they're literally parents, like, who are my parents' age, who are advocates for queer, trans, IA plus Korean folks. You know, they're advocates for us, and they help communicate between parents and, you know, their kids. And so they kind of serve as this bridge, you know, this intergenerational bridge, because I think a lot of the chasm and the not understanding and a lot of the, I mean, it's quite a violent, you know, chasm that exists, I think, between generations, as far as Korean folks are concerned, is, they serve as a resource and a source of love and support, emotional, mental, financial. I mean, it's just like anybody can reach out to them and just be like, help, whether you're a parent or a kid, you know?
Yeah, I remember at the concert for that conference that you performed in, they had like moms going around with like free hug signs that you could get like a hug from an API parent.
Oh my gosh.
And when they spoke to you, like the whole room just was like sobbing by the end. It was so good.
It was so good. And so healing in a way that I wonder, I'm sure you felt this too, I felt like a hole inside of me. Like close up like a wound. I didn't realize that was there. You know, I just didn't realize how much I didn't actually get that kind of hug of like, I validate you and your choices.
Yeah.
Like go have sex with whoever you want to have sex with. Like I'm proud of you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You also said you wanted to shout out the Developing Artists.
Yes, Developing Artists. Now they don't necessarily, you know, they don't identify as a QT org, but they are a company that's run by my really good friends, Jin and Jill, and they serve artists from marginalized communities. And you know, definitely across economic spectrums and racial identities and sexuality identities. And they really do it with a lot of integrity and authenticity, and they don't give a fuck. And it's amazing to see an organization not give a fuck who are there for the youth, to help the youth not give a fuck. I feel like that is so rare, you know, because somehow we find a way to just to like turn the youth into eunuchs. You know, we turn them into like little golden children, and developing artists is really there to honor the artists in them. And they're just an amazing organization, and I'm always going to stand by their cause and do whatever I can to spotlight them and give them my money.
Thanks for sharing this with us, Diana. That sounds incredible. I can't wait to look up more about them.
Yay.
So this is our section where we talk about older theater and how we queer it. So there are so many problematic representations of Asian folks in the theater canon. Is there one that you particularly want to correct and queer or just get rid of?
Oh my God. Okay. Thank God this outlet is here, because I watched Little Shop of Horrors for the first time over, you know, quarantine, and I'd never seen it. I'd only seen pieces of it, but I saw it in its entirety. And then, you know, the plant shop owner in Little Shop of Horrors?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Oh, it's like, it's, his name is Chang, right? Or something, right?
I haven't seen it in a while.
Yeah. Damn. I'm like, okay. Blanking. I haven't seen the
is
movie
this the
either.
Movie?
So the movie.
Yeah, it's
the
movie. It's the movie. Okay. And it's okay that you're blanking, because you would blink on the Asian character in Little Shop of Horrors, because he's like motherfucker who comes out of his plant shop dressed in like fucking, like, bought this fucking costume at Ricky's, doesn't have a line, you know, doesn't say shit, and just comes out to just be like the laughing, like he sold the white man like a freaky ass exotic plant. And then that's the character of Chang, right? And I was like, yo, what if they did Little Shop of Horrors, Chang's resurrection or some shit? And you just have to like, this is a solo show about Chang, and like, fuck all those like white people getting into trouble with a fucking plant. Like, let's talk about Chang and his relationship with all his plants and why he even has these like dope ass plants.
Right.
Or just get rid of it. Or just get rid of it and don't try. And then just like figure out a different way to make us look dope, you know?
I would love for someone to go to a revival of Little Shop and the second act is just all Chang hanging out with his plants. Maybe like,
yes.
Make him a human person. That would be amazing.
That would be amazing. With lines.
Wow. Now I have to go back and watch the movie just to know what this is.
I know. I can't. Oh. Terrible.
Yeah, you're going to boycott Little Shop afterward. You're going to be like, I hate that musical.
I doubt the stage productions have that, or I wonder if it's like written to be an Asian character, because I feel like I don't think I've seen a production of Little Shop with any Asian people in it.
Wow. All right. Well, yeah. I've never read the libretto. I mean, and it didn't make me want to pick. I mean, it's amazing. Little Shop is amazing. But damn, Chang is. That was quite the offense.
Yeah. Huh. Well, thank you. I'm glad we got to speak about this.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Also, like, unexpected one. I'm glad we're, like, speaking truth to the Little Shop situation.
It's so insidious. That's in, like, such random, like, Asian racism is in such random shows. Like, Dames at Sea has a song that they didn't cut in this last revival. Like, why? Why is it still there?
Really?
Because people are really that dumb. You know, people are just like, this is what they're like, these Asian people. They don't mind. This actor doesn't mind sitting in tech for 40 hours to just come on and, like, I don't know, move a plant or whatever.
Or, like, all other aspects of theater. It's, like, sentimental value of things is winning over any actual change.
Yeah. My friend Jack Phillips Moore, who works at the Public, who ran the writing group that I was in there, he says nostalgia is violence.
Mm.
And then Jesse Cameron Alec, who is the one half of the Doc and Jesse team at the Public. Jesse is the other person who runs the writing group at the Public. He says bureaucracy is violence. Is violence. Bureaucracy is violence.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think both are true.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Especially in theater. So another part of our show that we have with every episode is we would love to hear from you on some of your queer culture recs outside of theater. What kind of queer culture are you indulging in?
Ooh, wow. Making tea. I love making tea. I don't know if that's necessarily like a queer cultural thing, but I feel like, I mean, the reason why it feels queer to me is because it's like, I'm going to slow down and really take care of myself and in that way take care of you, you know, because I just find that, at least in what I identify as my queer community, I just feel like it's so sensitive and and we're so emotionally tethered and all that jazz. I'm really, oh my God. I love making fun of Love is Blind. I know that that's not a queer cultural rec, but the activity of making fun of Love is Blind as a queer person is like
a total recommendation.
Yeah. So fun. Dance parties. I know what I'm saying are not.
No. Do you think a queer Love is Blind would work?
Of course I do. That would be lit. That would be so lit. That would be like, I'll take you and you and you.
Right? It would be so much better. Well, they'll never do it, but it would be so much better.
Well, there's that show. Is it? I think it's called Are You the One? Where they put like 15 strangers in a house and they've done all these like love tests. And you have like a soulmate in the house and you have to figure out which one is yours.
Oh my God.
And then if everyone gets it correct, they all get like $1 million. But there's like a season, like season like 8, I think, is all bisexual people. So they could literally be matched up with anyone. And it is just like queer anarchy. I loved it so much.
Wow. No kidding. Okay, fine, queer. Yeah, I don't know. I just feel like, oh my God, you're weird. Pen 15 feels, they just feel so queer to me.
Yeah, I
I love that. A Black Lady sketch show. A Black Lady sketch show is so dope. It's on HBO. Watch it now.
Awesome.
It's awesome.
Will do. Do you have any specific tea recommendations?
Well, right now I'm making the pot of tea I'm making. Oh my God. My tea set is so queer. My tea set is like, oh, it's just so flowery and so sparkly. And it's just, I love
amazing.
It. Yeah. I'm like so hot and gay for my tea set. right now I'm making Tower of London by Harney and Sons. My favorite tea is the Paris tea from Harney and Sons. I really am a big fan. I also, what I love to do is I love going to the Korean market and getting barley tea and having an iced pitcher of barley tea in my fridge at all times during the summer. It's so good. Now I'm just looking in my fridge for like my queer cultural
food choices.
That's where we keep all of our queer culture. Our fridge.
I'm like, my oat milk is really queer.
Yeah, it is.
Superfood creamer.
We're getting a visual tour of Diana's fridge right now. It's great.
This vegan pesto I made with bacon in
queer.
It. That's queer.
Wait, vegan with bacon. Love
it. With bacon. Yeah, definitely.
Key.
This non-dairy frozen dessert from Pinkberry.
Ooh. Now I'm
you got
hungry.
All the priorities in this fridge. Ice cream, bacon, pesto. So good. Wait, have you ever been to the Harney and Sons headquarters?
Hell yeah.
It's so great.
Yeah. Oh my God. It's so great and overpriced and great.
It's too expensive. But I accidentally ended up there and I was like, this is basically like a magical world.
Right.
I just stepped through.
Is it the tea place?
Yeah, but it's like weirdly here. It's not that far away. It's like an hour, right? It's like an hour and a half away or something like that.
I don't remember. It's like in Massachusetts or New York or like, you know, it could be in either one. I don't remember.
but there's like a tea concierge and they like ask you what you want to try and they like brew it up on the spot and set a timer to make sure it's like the appropriate brew time. It's wacky. It's great.
It's wild, man.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome.
Now I'm eating this non-dairy frozen dessert and it's really good.
That's probably what I'm going to do after this. So last but not least, Diana, how can people find you online? How can they follow you?
You can find me on Instagram because that's all I can handle in terms of social media. Okay. You can find me on Instagram at Oh Yeah Diana, OHYEADIANA. There's no yeah after the H because my Korean name is Yebin, which means artistic light in Korean. So Oh Yeah Diana. Or my website is www.dianao.co. Please be my friend.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
And thanks for the fridge tour. That was a good finale that we didn't anticipate.
You're welcome. Thanks for being receptive.
Thanks for listening. If you like, please rate and review us and share us with your friends.
Come back for more interviews, fun queer content, recommendations, and eventually discussions on current theater. We are so excited to hear your queer culture recommendations or any of your ideas on how we could queer the canon. You can call us, yes, actually call us, and leave us a voicemail at 845-445-9251 or send us an email at thesisonjoan@gmail.com.
And follow us on social media. We're on Instagram and Twitter at thesisonjoan. Until next time, keep it queer.
Not that it'd be that hard for y'all to do.
Okay, we're recording. In my tent.
Okay.
Holly, you look great in your blanket fort.
Thank you.
Also, you can put your blanket down as I'm talking.
It got really hot.
Yeah, all three arms have to be exhausted. It's been a long time.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.